Dr. Harry Abrams of the Vanderbilt School of Medicine speaks on ethical dilemmas in modern medicine.
I'll start out by saying that my talk will be somewhat informal in the sense that I've just gotten back to Nashville from another meeting which had to do with bioethics, and when I was talking about coming here, I was somewhat reluctant because I felt like I had not had as much time as I would have liked to have prepared anything very formal. What I thought I'd do is tell you to some extent about the meeting I was at, and to give you a sort of a disorganized look at how I see bioethics, and then I understand that you all have lots of questions, and we can open it up for what you have on your minds. Can you hear me all right? Is this better, or is it working? Or should I just talk louder? Okay. My interest in this is as a psychiatrist, and began some years ago by being interested in how patients react to physical illness and to surgical procedures. And from that point, got quite involved with patients on the artificial kidney, patients having open heart surgery, and then going on to patients having kidney transplants. And as I got more into these areas, it became pretty obvious to me that there were many ethical questions that I felt not very competent to answer, but also found that when I looked around and when I tried to find other answers, I found that other people didn't seem to know much more than I. So that for some years I've tried in my own way to grapple with these problems. Things have changed dramatically, as you know. When I was a medical intern, psychiatric resident, in the late 1950s, these issues were not talked about. I can remember a case of an old man who was dying, and the psychiatric resident who was working with me at the time, I had just joined the faculty, said he didn't want to treat this patient with penicillin. That man had pneumonia because he felt like that there was not much sense in this man's living anymore. I thought this would be an interesting case for a conference. When I tried to set this up in the medical school, I was told that this was not done. That these were decisions that doctors made sort of in their own minds in a rather secretive fashion, and they were not things that were talked about openly. I think you know since that time things have changed very much. Also, in even trying to look at ethics at that time, I remember going to the medical library, and the only thing I could find was a small dark red AMA book about that thin on ethics, and this basically had to do with how doctors were polite to one another, and how you referred patients, and whom you charged and whom you didn't, and that sort of thing. Well, obviously that's changed also in the AMA, or the JAMA, as you know, gotten quite interested in this whole area of ethics and has published some very good articles. Probably the best way for me to start, I think, would be to go over an editorial which was in the Honolulu paper where this conference was held. This was a conference called a National Conference on Emerging Medical, Moral, and Ethical Issues. And it was sponsored mainly by the National Kidney Foundation and by St. Francis Hospital, and stemmed basically from the nephrologist working at St. Francis, finding that they had patients on the artificial kidney dying of terminal kidney failure who were having all sorts of psychiatric and medical problems, and patients were asking that they be taken off of the artificial kidney, or the families were asking, or the doctors were wondering if it was worthwhile to keep these patients on the artificial kidney. And the doctors there got very interested in this whole problem and set up a conference to deal with these issues. And it was made up mainly of ethicists and philosophers and lawyers. I was the only psychiatrist, and there were really very few doctors there except for the nephrologist who had set up the meeting. And it was covered well in the paper. And this is an editorial which came out after the meeting, which was entitled End of Guilt. And it seemed to me to summarize pretty much what had gone on at that conference. St. Francis Hospital made a substantial contribution to the community last week with this conference on medical procedures to prolong life. In an age when tissue can be kept alive almost indefinitely, but when society still has only limited resources to allot to medicine, what values should prevail? The conference brought together doctors, lawyers, clergy, and laymen to talk about the complex medical, moral, and legal concerns raised by the vast improvements in medicine. When kidney dialysis machines and kidney transplant donations are limited, for instance, who should be served and who should be denied service? When a case is terminal, what procedures are proper, and what rights do a patient or his agents have to reject life-prolonging procedures? The encouraging note arising from the conference is that there is a broad area of agreement on fundamental guidelines, and that Hawaii may be somewhat ahead of the rest of the nation in recognizing situations where medical heroics are neither desirable nor required. Among the areas of agreement, and I thought these were fairly good, an adult patient who is rational and informed has a right to ask for treatment or to refuse it. When a patient is not rational or cannot communicate, his agents must decide on the level of treatment. In terminal cases, decisions must weigh the possibility of future useful life. Machines, one speaker said, must be used to prolong living, not to prolong dying. I think that was from my talk. Positive euthanasia, the direct killing of a patient, is psychologically repugnant to most people. But the passive euthanasia of standing back while they have natural processes produce death in hopeless cases is almost universally acceptable. And maybe that's a point that you talked about that I think we should get back to, that is the difference between so-called passive and active euthanasia. A patient who refuses life prolonging measures still is entitled to care for other needs and comfort. The physician's recommendation, rather than court orders, should be relied on, and the physician has the responsibility to offer his best opinion as part of the decision-making process. He can often strengthen his relationship to the patient and the family by counseling with others, including psychiatrists and clergy. Wider awareness that is not necessary, either morally, legally, or medically, to carry life-prolonging efforts on beyond the point of reasonableness should be of great help to the families facing an impending death. It should do much to relieve the feelings of guilt many families experience. As I say, I think that covers the situation pretty well. I'm sure there are many ways that we can look at the problem, and that you have. As I see the main ones, and these came out at the conference, I think one can look at these from an ethical, philosophical fashion, from a moral, religious fashion, from a legal fashion. And I think that's something we have to take into account, and I'll mention that. And finally, from a clinical viewpoint. And I guess it's the latter that I've been most interested in and where I have found myself personally having the most difficulty dealing with the area. That is, I have found it easy, it has seemed to me that it has been easy for some ethicists who are not involved in the direct care of the patient to make statements such as, this patient should not be treated, he's hopeless, I would surreptitiously give this patient injection of potassium. There's no hope in his living, he's not a person, and so forth. That although it might be easy for some people to say this, and it might make some sense from an ethical viewpoint, when you're dealing with a patient, and when you know the patient and the family, I don't think it's quite that simple. Either from an ethical viewpoint or from a legal viewpoint, in the sense that as our laws now stand, it would be murder, in this state at least, if one either did not treat a patient when he should be, or obviously if he carried out some form of active euthanasia. I think that takes us into the whole question of active versus passive euthanasia. And I'm sure you've been told many times to know what the definition of euthanasia is, and that is that it's a easy death. At least that's one of the definitions. And I think people feel that's one of the things that's often lost, is that definition has been taken out and that instead it has been looked upon as some form of killing or something which is not comfortable for the patient. But there have been some interesting writings about what is really the difference. If you have a patient who is dying of pneumonia, as I just said, and if you give the patient penicillin, he'll live. But if you don't give penicillin and he dies of a natural death, in essence, have you taken his life in the sense that if you had not given him something? Is that the same as doing something actively to take his life? Well, I think from a psychological viewpoint, as was mentioned in this editorial, there does seem to be a difference, and that people seem to be more comfortable from the idea under some circumstances you would not start treatment or you would not keep up a treatment in a patient who was terminally ill or who was hopeless, as opposed to doing something in which you would actively inject something into the patient that would take his life. And maybe that's something we can get back to in the sense of, is there a difference between active and passive euthanasia? Another very important point which came out at this conference had to do with ordinary versus extraordinary means. And as you know, this gets to be very important. If you have a patient who is dying, and if you put in a cardiac pacemaker, you might keep him alive. Is that an ordinary or is that an extraordinary way in which you treat him? And how far does one have to go in his treatment of a patient? Now, some people at the conference felt, and I think I'm not sure if this is hedging, but that we should really drop these two words because they have so many other psychological meanings to us, and that we should go to reasonable versus not reasonable, that we should use these words instead. In some cases, you might feel that putting the patient who was dying of cancer on the artificial kidney, for example, would not be reasonable treatment, and that takes it out of the realm of ordinary versus extraordinary. Again, maybe this is something that we should come back to, and I think it's obviously something that shifts in some ways. For example, kidney transplants, this is no longer something which is considered research. This is treatment at this particular time. So in that sense, one would put this in the category of something which is reasonable. Cardiac pacemakers. Now these are done on a relatively routine basis. And if one has an 80-year-old aunt who is demented, and who has asked to die in the past, and she's going into heart failure, and the medical intern wants to put in a cardiac pacemaker, you might say to him, well, this is seems to be something that's not reasonable, or it's not done on an everyday basis. It seems heroic. And the medical intern, who was just out of medical school, will tell you, no, cardiac pacemakers are put in every day. So I would not consider this an extraordinary way of treating a patient. Let me tell you something about some of the problems that I see as far as medical advances. One which I was quite involved with had to do with patients who were taken on the artificial kidney and those that weren't. As you know, when this first started back in the early 1960s, this was written about in Life magazine, Red Book, and some other places, about selection committees, mainly done in Seattle, Washington. And there would be long discussions about which patients should be selected and which ones should not. And the decisions were basically made on what was known as social worth, and that a group of lay people, usually after names had been passed on to them in an anonymous fashion by a medical committee, would decide among four patients which ones should be taken on the kidney and which ones should not be, and those patients would die. Now, what happened through the years and what's present now is that I think fortunately we're kind of out of that situation. There's now enough state, federal funding where most patients who need the artificial kidney can have it. And what's happened is that selection is no longer necessary. And I really think that's for the best. And having been involved in having to select patients myself at one point, after wrestling with the issue for some years, I finally felt that this was something that shouldn't be done, and that if there were not enough machines to dialyze patients, that basically what we should have gone to was what is called a first-come, first-served. That is, if you had 10 machines, you would take the first 10 patients, and then you wouldn't dialyze anymore until you had an opening. Because I felt very uncomfortable trying to decide which patient was more valuable, whose life was more valuable than another's. I felt that was not humanly possible. Another method which I talked about at the time and wrote about with James Childress in this book that was mentioned was to have a lottery. And if you only had 10 dialysis machines and you had 15 patients, that you should put the 15 names in the hat, pull out 10 names. Well, maybe that wasn't feasible, but from an ethical viewpoint, I felt like we were on very shaky grounds trying to make these social value decisions. Now I don't think we have to worry about that, at least until federal funds, if there are problems there, then we're going to have to face that. Or when people start asking questions, should we be putting federal funds into people dying of terminal kidney failure, or should we be putting this money into starving children or some other area, then maybe these questions are going to come back. Or are there going to be enough persons who will be treating patients? And that's an interesting area which I really can't get into, but it now seems to be a problem in the sense of, are there going to be enough dialysis nurses who can withstand the stress to work with these patients? Now, I think it does take us to the second point about the artificial kidney, and that is, what when you have the patient who no longer wishes to live while he's being dialyzed? As you know, it's a procedure which takes up many hours of the patient's life. For the rest of his life, he is either on the artificial kidney for about 30 hours a week, or he gets a kidney transplant. He has to stay on a very rigid diet. He can't drink very much fluid. He frequently doesn't feel well. There are other problems, sexual problems, which patients have at times being impotent. The patients can't work. What I noticed after working with these patients for a number of years was that a fair number seemed to be killing themselves. Again, there seemed to be two ways in which this was happening. Sort of an active sort of suicide in which patients on the artificial kidney were taking overdoses, shooting themselves in the head, cutting their shunts, in which they were dialyzed, bleeding to death. These are what I call active suicides. There are other cases in which the patient would no longer stay on the diet, or would start drinking lots of fluid, or would not come in to be dialyzed, and seemed to be saying, I no longer wish to live in this fashion. So we sent out we had about four or five of these patients where I was, so we sent out a questionnaire to various dialysis centers in the country, and we got back responses on about 4,000 patients, and it turns out that about 5% of this population had committed what I was calling active suicide. If you look at these figures, they're very much higher than the normal population of suicide, which is about 1 per 10,000. This is much higher than that. So what has happened now is that, as I see it, if you put these two things together, as far as the selection and the patients being dialyzed, is that now more patients are being dialyzed. But as more patients are being dialyzed, one is seeing more psychiatric problems, and one is being faced more with these sorts of problems, which is really why this other conference was held, which I mentioned. That is that patients were on the machines more, and questions were being raised, such as should a patient be allowed to stop treatment if he wanted, if a patient was being dialyzed, he had a stroke, or if he went blind, was it indicated to keep dialyzing him? My own feelings about this, which I guess have really come through working with the patients and thinking about it, is that if one runs into these circumstances and the patient feels that his life holds no meaning for him, and he is running into multiple physical complications, I feel that at times you have to go along with this decision. Or at times we don't even have the power to say otherwise, even if we'd like to, that he's going to take himself off the artificial kidney, for example, in spite of what is told him or what is done for him. Let me just skip on a bit to the patient who gets the kidney transplant. There are obvious ethical questions here, such as when does one donate a kidney and when does one not? What is the family's motivation? Whether mother wanting to give her kidney to her son when it might put her life in jeopardy. Not very much as far as the operation, but what if in years to come she gets an infection in the only kidney which she has left? What obligation does she have to her other children, to her family, not to give the kidney? There were some interesting cases, which this is not done very much anymore, of so-called living unrelated donors, in the sense this would not be a mother or a brother or anybody related to the patient needing the kidney, but someone would walk off the street and say, I want to give my kidney to a stranger who's dying of kidney failure. And this did happen. Is this an act of love? Is this a gift? Or is this some sort of psychological conflict which the patient had? This even happened a couple of cases with the heart transplants when they were being done more often. And one patient came in and said he wanted to trade his good heart for the bad heart of the patient who was dying, which was obviously was not done. But there was a psychiatrist who suggested, and I don't know if this was done with tongue-in-cheek or not, that patients be allowed, patients who were suicidally depressed, that they be allowed to give a kidney. That this was a way of getting rid of their own guilt, a way of giving something to somebody, and maybe this would be a way of helping them. The whole area of informed consent, which maybe you've talked about, is a very interesting psychological area. It's talked about very much in any sort of clinical research. Anything which you do with the patient has to be informed. Well, what's happened is, when this has been studied, and you might know about some of these, that, for example, when a patient, when a family is asked who should give the kidney and who shouldn't, this is not done in a very rational way. It's usually done in an impulsive, unconscious manner, that somehow the decision is made, but it's not very well thought out. The other thing which has been found is that patients often don't hear what's being told to them. And as you know, there was a study done recently in which a surgeon went back after he had operated on patients and told them what was going to happen and asked them what they remembered about what they had been told, and they only remembered about 20% of what the surgeon had told them. So I think we have to be aware that what we think of as informed consent and what we might think the patient hears is not often what he hears. Let me just move on. I think we'll skip some of the other problems here, which you apparently have talked about, such as problems of newborn infants, which you might want to get back to when there are problems when the doctors feel that the case is hopeless or the family does not want the infant treated, what should be done. I think there are many other problems which are coming up, for example, the treatment of cancer. And when a patient is dying of cancer and he has to go through treatment, which at times is worse than the disease as far as chemotherapy and so forth, is this something which should be imposed on the patient? Obviously, one of the main issues here, and this came up, and I'm sure it's come up in your discussion, is when is as I see it in very simple terms, when is a person not a person? When you have a patient who's dying of cancer, or if you have a newborn infant, or if you have a patient who's being dialyzed and he can't talk to anybody, if he's had a stroke, is he still a person? Are we keeping a human being alive? Are we keeping something which is non-human alive, in the sense that even though his heart is still beating, he has no other way that he is alive, in the sense of how he is relating to other people, or what meaning life has to him? Now, this obviously leads into the whole concept of cerebral death. And this has become a very important issue. And there are states now which, you know, have this as a law, in the sense that if the EEG is flat for a certain number of hours, and after a certain number of EEG runs, and there are other things such as the patient not having reflexes and so forth, is this patient dead or alive? From a biological viewpoint, in a sense, he isn't. And that is the whole essence of the law. Now, there's been a recent law passed in this state, which I think is interesting. And I'm not sure how many states have this law now. I think it's, or in some form. But it's, I think, somewhere around 13 or 14. And the law here was just passed in March 1976. And that's a very simply worded act, and I think it makes sense. And it is that for all legal purposes, a human body, when irreversible cessation of total brain function.
Please turn to side two.
Which is according to the usual and customary standards of medical practice, shall be considered dead. that for us is a lot in a very simple way. And I think you'll see one thing it doesn't mention has to do with EEG, because some patients who are terminal and who would be considered having a brain death, the doctors might not do an EEG. And what you find is, under some circumstances, a patient can have a totally flat EEG for some time, which might be due to a subdural hematoma, for example, in which he has a blood clot in his brain. And when the clot is taken out, the EEG comes back. So at times, the EEG is not that useful. On the other hand, there's an interesting study done in which a doctor took a dummy and put him in an intensive care unit, and on his head he put a bowl of lime jello. I'm not quite so sure why he used lime jello, but he took the mold and took the bowl off and put it on the dummy's head, and then he put electrodes on the jello, and he found that he got waves on EEG. And his point was that, you know, one cannot always use the isoelectric EEG to make the diagnosis of brain death. And I think that's why I was left out of this law. The other issue, which came up, it has to do with the living will, which you have probably talked about, and which I have a copy, and which I, if you don't, would you like to hear this, or have you gone into this? Do you all know about it, and has it come up? I can just read it. As you know, this is not considered a legal document at this point. To my family, my physician, my lawyer, my clergyman, to any medical facility in whose care I happen to be, to any individual who may become responsible for my health, welfare, or affairs. This was that death is much a reality as birth, growth, maturity, and old age. It is the one certainty of life. If the time comes when I, and then there's a blank to fill your name in, can no longer take part in decisions for my own future, let this statement stand as an expression of my wishes while I am still of sound mind, If the situation should arise in which there is no reasonable expectation for my recovery from physical or mental disability, I request that I be allowed to die and not be kept alive by artificial means or heroic measures, unquote. I do not fear death itself as much as the indignities of deterioration, dependence, and hopeless pain. I therefore ask that the medication be mercifully administered to me to alleviate suffering, even though this may hasten the moment of death. The request is made after careful consideration. I hope you who care for me will feel morally bound to follow its mandate. I recognize that this appears to place a heavy responsibility upon you, but it is with the intention of relieving you of such responsibility and of placing it upon myself in accordance with my strong conviction that this statement is made. I frankly have some doubts about this, even though I'm on the Euthanasia Council here in Nashville. But I think my main concern about it is, and this has nothing to do with any legal implications, is that this is something that I might want to sign right now when I feel like I'm in relatively good health. But if I were dying, or if I then get a terminal illness, would I then feel the way that I do now when I sign this? Obviously, this is something that can then be torn up and not used. But this is one thing which I have some sort of personal concerns about the use of the living will. Well, let me end up with some general comments. I think one of the basic issues which I feel is very much involved in all of this, and I'm sorry I'm sort of all over the map. I'm a strong believer in the doctor-patient relationship, And I think this is where the basic decision should be made. I think it should be made basically between the doctor and the patient. That is, when their decisions to treat or not to treat. That at times, the family has to be involved, and the pastor, and apparently this came up in one of your discussions last night. My feeling is that it should be basically be the doctor's decision whether he thinks treatment should be continued or not, and this should not be placed on the patient or the family. That he ought to, let's just take the case in which the patient can't make up his own mind, if we have an infant, that the doctor should basically tell the patient, I mean, tell the family what he thinks should be done, and then let the family say what they think. That it is, I think it produces too much guilt on the family to have them make up their own minds about what to do with the patient. That this is, I think the doctor is ducking his responsibility if he just says, well, I want you all to decide if you want this member of your family treated or not. I think it's very important that there be some consultation. And that if the doctor is going to decide a terminally ill patient or an infant whom he feels he does not want to operate on, that if he's going to make that decision with the family, that he call in some other doctors and to get some independent opinions. I think that we've moved too far for one doctor in himself to make these decisions. Two other points. One is that if the decision is made not to treat someone, such as an infant, who has no brain and no chance of living, that if the doctor does not operate or the family does not want the patient treated, that the infant should be kept comfortable until the time of its death. I think that's very important. It's often overlooked. That means that one would sedate the infant, that one would continue feeding the infant. But one might decide not to operate or not to give some form of medication, but that you just don't let the infant die in a state in which he might or she might be feeling pain. And the last point, it has to be that if that decision is made and while it's being made, there obviously has to be family support, and one has to work with the family. And I think this is something which is often overlooked. That if the patient is dying and if the decision is made not to treat the patient further, then one doesn't stop there. And that one has to stay with the patient and with the family until the time of death. And then I'm sure, as you know, that there are many repercussions of grief and depression and so forth which come up months and years after the death. And that one has to be available to work with the family long after the decision is made.
My task here is to make some summary statements that, and hopefully offer some suggestions to, for the church in keeping these kind of conferences going and keeping our focus on these issues. But yesterday morning, I suggested that this conference had three primary purposes. I'd like to return to these purposes now. Let's see if we've met the purpose. As you may remember, the first purpose was to affirm that Christianity is a religion that speaks to all the issues of life. We were called to say that nothing is outside the scope of Christian truth, that all truth is Christ's truth. I believe repeatedly the speakers in this conference have affirmed this theme. They have pointed out that not only is it possible for Christianity to speak to these issues, it is essential for Christians to become involved in them. I said at the beginning that we would not always agree, and we have not. There have been differences of opinion. A TV reporter asked me this morning to give the Southern Baptist Convention position on abortion. I was unable to do that. I referred him to Dr. Sullivan. truth of the matter is that many of us in here have published papers on abortion that differ in some regard. But we have had a common unity in this conference. As you know, there is risk in having a conference like this. There is a danger that we'll be misunderstood. There is a danger that some people will take some word or some sentence out of context and misinterpret what is going on here. But the Christian Life Commission has felt that these issues must not be avoided by the church, that they are too serious for us not to give attention to them. And so we have felt that it is worth the risk. And I hope that those who hear about this conference and what we have done here will recognize that there has been a unity in this conference. Even though there have been differences of opinion, there's been a unity based on the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. A second purpose of the conference has been to identify some of the critical problems related to biomedical ethics. We have sought to ask the right questions about some great issues of life. And I believe we have done this. We have asked about everything from birth to death. We have asked about everything from cloning to pulling the plug. And we have not only dealt with issues, we have also dealt with methodologies for decision making. We have looked at the ways in which we should be dealing with these issues. I believe we have met the purpose in this conference. And the third purpose that I mentioned was that we hope to bear witness to the fact that the church can get involved in helping people find solutions to these problems. Riding to the airport yesterday afternoon, Kenneth Bach said, the best place to deal with these biomedical issues is in the church. The best place, he said, the best hope for our being open to tell it like it is should be in the church, where people from various disciplines can come together. And so we're going to look at some suggestions for actions then as we conclude, and I want to begin by offering a thumbnail sketch of a theology for actions in this regard. I'm not going to develop a theology, but if I were, let me just share with you a model, an outline that we could use in acting through the church to deal with these biomedical issues. Perhaps that theology in its development could be fodder for another conference. If I were going to try to develop a basis for action through the church, I would talk about God's activity in the world as the creator, as the judge, as the redeemer. I would draw upon the ideas of H. Richard Niebuhr and E. Clinton Gardner, Waldo Beach, and others who have talked about the fact that God is not disinterested in our affairs, but he is active in the world, that he is creating, he is judging, and he is redeeming, and that we are called to respond to what he is doing in the world. And this is a theme that runs throughout the Bible, and I believe it is a theme that can be applied to our understanding of biomedical issues. We are called to respond to what God is doing as creator, and that means, among other things, that we should respond with celebration of life. We can affirm the goodness of the body. We have too often missed this note of celebration. We fail when we get into issues like this to cultivate a sense of awe and wonder in looking at the creation and in looking at human life. We can also respond to the Creator with stewardship. We are called, as Dan McGee and others who have been in this conference have pointed out, we are called to participate with God in finishing the creation. McGee said it well. He said there are two ways to fail as stewards. We fail as stewards when we misuse what we have, and we also fail as stewards when we do not use what we have. We are called to be stewards, and stewardship is required of lab researchers, of nurses, of practitioners, of surgeons, anesthesiologists, pastors, geneticists, chaplains, all of us. We must also respond not only to God's activity as creator, but to God's activity as judge. He is governing and sustaining what he has made. We must respond with repentance for our failures. Sin, indeed, as Kenneth Bach pointed out, is relevant for us as we deal with biomedical issues. Celebration is not enough. We must repent of using those to whom we should minister. We must repent for stepping on others for our own professional advancement in this field. We must repent of allowing money to crowd out ministry. We must repent for turning research into me-search. A response to the judge also requires the restraint of evil in society, a very controversial matter indeed. But given the reality of sin, guidelines are necessary to make certain that there are checks and balances when we deal with these foul medical issues. The wisdom of a variety of disciplines must be translated into guidelines for actions related to bioethics. Not everything that is scientifically possible is morally responsible. We should not do everything that we can do in the field of technology. Careful exchange of ideas is necessary to restrain those evils which could damage individuals and even alter the course of the human race. And the third aspect of a thumbnail sketch of a theology for action would be that we should respond to what God is doing as Redeemer. From God's redemptive act in Jesus Christ, we have learned and are learning about love, and this love must characterize our actions in the field of biomedical ethics. Love is not irrelevant to what we're talking about here, not the kind of self-giving love based on what God has done in Jesus Christ. It speaks to us in all that we do. It keeps our actions channeled in the right direction. It informs us when we make decisions. God's redemptive activity, we also learn not only about love, but also about community. And biomedical actions require an interdisciplinary approach. None of us alone can bring an adequate perspective to these issues. We need help from each other. We need wisdom from each other. I was pleased that Dr. Harry Abram, the psychiatrist who spoke this morning, invited me to come over to Vanderbilt Hospital with him and make ethical rounds. I'm going. I look forward to that. The church is a community where people can come together and talk to one another and share fears and dreams, and we must respond to God's redemptive activity, therefore, by participation in community. And we must respond to the Redeemer with hope. There are developments that are so disrupting, so shattering, that we go into what Toffler called a future shock, similar to physical shock. But we're not without hope, a hope that comes through Jesus Christ, who gives us not only wisdom, but also motivation for dealing with these issues. And so we must respond to the Creator, to the Judge, and to the Redeemer. And that sort of thumbnail theology sketch is the kind that we might use as we try to act practically to deal with foul medical issues to the church. Now, as we conclude, let me just suggest 7 very practical things that we might do to keep this kind of emphasis going, and then I'd entertain some other practical suggestions. I'll just give you a few sentences here, 7 sentences or so about the. And ask if you have any other suggestions, after which we will conclude the conference. As I say, these are very practical suggestions. 1, communicate repeatedly that Christianity is indeed relevant to biomedical issues. 2, raise these issues. Help people ask the right questions. Sensitize people to the problem. Realize that focus must be given to the issues. Last night, a photographer came around from a newspaper to take a picture of some who were participating in the conference, and I invited him to stay. He said he would like to, but he couldn't because he was on his way to take a picture of Tiny Tim, who was in town. And it was a sort of symbol to me of the fact that he was dealing with the biomedical ethics conference, and then he was going to take a picture of Tiny Tim. Life goes on. We have issues that need to be raised repeatedly. We need to sensitize people in the midst of many competing interests, that there are important things that have not been dealt with and need to be dealt with. In the third place, provide opportunities for people from various disciplines and professions to talk to each other, to break down suspicions and fears, to promote understanding and trust, to become acquainted with each other's problems and perspectives. 4, provide resources for dealing with these issues. Let me tell you about the best bibliography that I know anything about on this general field. It's published by the Institute of Society, Ethics, and the Life Sciences. Here it is right here. It's a bibliography of society, ethics, and the lifestyle. It's available from this institute, and I believe there's information in the packet which you received as to how you could get it. This is an extensive bibliography published in 1975. Perhaps it's been updated this year, but in any case, this is the best single bibliography that I know about on this issue. But there's material coming out all the time. Dr. Ruth stopped me in the hall today and said that last night when he got home, National Geographic had a whole new issue that dealt with a new biology. So there are resources that are available, popular and technical, and we should seek to provide these resources in various ways for individuals. I suppose almost a universal question that we've gotten here at the conference is, will these lectures be reproduced? And the answer is that the hope is that they will be. Either they will be published by a publisher who is considering doing this, or else we will find perhaps another way to reproduce the proceedings for those of you who are at the conference. And if you did not register and give your address and, to the secretary, please do so before you leave, and we will get some word to you about the availability of the proceedings. In the fifth place, minister to those who are caught up in making these tough decisions. Help people keep on keeping on. Help isolated families to get into a community so that decisions can be made with the help of others. In the sixth place, change social structures that need to be changed. There are a lot of changes that need to be made. Legislation that needs to be written. Regulations, government regulations that need to be altered. Medical facilities need influence of Christians who want to get involved to make things better. Not only should we minister then to individuals, we should also work to bring about social change. And seven, finally, we should provide structure conferences and dialogues to enable people to be educated to talk about these issues.
This concludes Dr. Hollis's statement.